Joining me on this edition is a man who's about to release his brand new studio album, These Days, a fine example of what we might call grown-up pop music, and early next year he'll be on tour to support it. In addition to his solo work, his CV is absolutely incredible, and I'm sure we'll be talking about one or two aspects of it. He was a founding member of Ace. For me, one of the fascinating things is that he played keyboards on the first album by The Smiths. He was the singer of Mike and the Mechanics' enduring male weepy, The Living Years. He's also played with B.B. King, Eric Clapton, Roger Waters, Squeeze, and even Roxy Music, amongst others. And his writing has been covered by Diana Ross and the Eagles, no less. Blimey. Paul Carrick, welcome to the Mouthcast.
Hiya, how you doing?
I'm very well, how are you, sir?
Yeah, good, good.
Okay, we're going to be talking about some of those things I just mentioned, not least, okay, of course, the new album. So I think it might make sense to have a listen to something from it. So here's Cold Light of Day.
www.themouthmagazine.com.
I've been enjoying listening to the new album for a few weeks, and I get the feeling there's sort of a thematic link between the songs. I can't quite put my finger on it, but the whole thing plays beautifully as an album, not just a random collection of some of the latest songs you've written.
Well, that's a good start. I like that idea. Well, it's not surprising, really. I mean, all the songs are kind of written more or less as an out, you know, at the same time, really.
Yeah.
I'm a bit lazy about writing. I don't write a lot of the time. I mean, I know guys who get up and write a song every day. I tend to write when it's time to make an album. And I think basically the songs are fairly normal. You know, there's nothing. So I think it's just as well to keep it fresh,
yeah,
you know. as I say, they're simple songs written in a traditional format, you know, a couple of verses, a middle bit and a chorus, you know. So I think that way it keeps it fresh. But, you know, the theme of the album is nothing intentional about that. It's just the way it comes together. And you look back and you think, oh, yeah, I see what we're doing.
Yeah, yeah.
As an album, it's recorded in one batch, really. The basic tracks were recorded in 3 days. And we did mess about with it with overdubs and what have you later. So it does have a kind of sonic thread, at least.
Yeah, and I guess, as you say, you don't necessarily write all the time. So I would guess these songs were written over a shorter period of time than might otherwise be the case. And therefore, whatever was going on for you in your life at that moment and the sort of general mood of your life would inform all of the songs, wouldn't it?
I think so, yeah. The album's called These Days, and it is about where I'm at. I'm getting on. I've had a long career. I've also had a good family life. And I've reached this point, and I'm still enjoying it, still doing what I'm doing. And so I guess that's the thread and gist of it in a nutshell.
You're very aware of where you are, kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, interestingly, casting our minds back, you're a Sheffield lad. You're originally from Sheffield. Richard Hawley described it to me as
the People's Republic of South Yorkshire.
Yes.
Yeah.
Do you still feel those ties?
Oh, very. Still ties. I mean, I've lived most of my life, to be honest, in the South.
Yeah.
So I'm more of a Southern softie. I married a London girl, basically. Because, I mean, as a teenager, I was playing in bands and going off for months at a time, then coming back to my mum's for a decent meal every now and again and get my washing done and that sort of stuff. But I think in my 20s, I'd already more or less made the move to live down here. And as I say, married a London girl. But I still have the links with family, football team for my sins, and my band are all Sheffield lads, actually. I hooked up with them about 20 years ago. They've more or less been with me ever since.
So I bet there's some camaraderie there that you don't actually get when you play with other people because of the fact you're all Yorkshire lads.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It's true, yeah. It's been really, really beneficial for me to have that kind of support. You know, we're down to earth guys. When we, you know, we go on tour, they're fully committed, you know.
Yeah.
There's no, they're not looking for their next gig. They're fully committed. They're behind it. We feel like we always feel like we're getting a little bit better all the time. You know, the gigs are better. People are coming. The band sounds better every year. And there's the commitment and heart there. I mean, if I was to ring them up now and say, you know what, we just got a gig in, can you make it tonight? They'd be there.
Yeah, yeah.
And you don't get that, you know. In
Southern softies.
In the other circles. Yeah.
I always think of that great Yorkshire thing, I say what I like and I bloody well like what I say. But you mentioned your football team there. You are, of course, a Wednesdayite,
I'm
supporter
afraid,
of Sheffield Wednesday, one of the city's two football teams.
Yep.
And as I say, I lived there not too far from Hillsborough and I popped along to a few games.
Yeah.
It would be during the era of David Hurst and I remember Chris Waddle was coming to the end of his career there.
John Sheridan.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you get to many games?
Yeah, I do. I have a season ticket.
Right. Excellent.
And so do my two sons and my grandson now has got his first. He's only six.
Excellent.
Poor little devil. He doesn't know what he's in for.
Indoctrinated.
I'm afraid so. Terrible thing to do to a child, really. But so, yeah, the football is a bit of a quandary. But that wasn't a bad era to go and see them. The one you saw, that was a hell of a team, actually.
Yes, it was great. In fact, I remember seeing them play Liverpool when Collymore was playing for Liverpool.
Oh, yeah.
I always thought Waddle was the greatest crosser of a ball I'd ever seen. But actually, in that game, Collymore was a fantastic crosser of the ball.
Really?
Unbelievable.
But, right. Well, good player. Yeah. Good player, Stan. No doubt about it.
So what was Sheffield like for you growing up? Because the impression I have is that it, you know, in the late 60s, early 70s, it might have felt a little bit behind the groove, a little bit sort of rainy back streets and all a bit noir, I suppose. But I guess the steel industry was still doing really well at the time. So.
Well, I think, it was. I imagine pretty much full employment and all that. You know, my folks were very much working class and my uncles and all that were all involved in steel or engineering and all the rest of it. And so you can imagine growing up and wanting to be in a band full time was not looked on as being a great idea at all.
Yeah.
I mean, work was religion, you know, and being in a band, no, not good at all. But
I always remember this thing that Bono said shortly after his dad had died. He said that U2 were playing somewhere, Madison Square Gardens or somewhere like that, somewhere huge, and they flew all of their family over from Dublin.
Yeah.
And at the sort of after party, Bono was introducing his dad to Springsteen and Dylan and whoever else, and his dad said, "This is all very well, Paul, but when are you going to get a proper job?"
No, we've all had that. Every guy in a band has had that, and particularly back then. I mean, it's pretty respectable now to pursue a career. You can probably do university degrees in it, but back then it was dodgy. There's no doubt about it. As I say, my lot were very much working class and very respectable. And to be sitting around the house during the day, God, blimey, you know.
Yeah.
It was really... as I said, all my uncles and aunts were involved in that. But my dad was self-employed. I mean, he was a painter and decorator.
Right.
We had a little shop at the corner and we lived in the room at the back and the two bedrooms up the top, with the outside toilet and all that. They worked their nuts off just to get ahead. And sadly, I lost my dad when I was about 11. He had an accident at work and that was it.
Right.
But, you learn a lot about being independent, and it's a slightly different attitude to working in big factories or companies. But,
Yeah.
I dreamt about you last night and I fell out.
Paul, I've wanted to ask you this for a long time, actually, about your work on the Smiths' first album. It was actually the second recording of that album. The original Troy Tate version didn't work out, so this new session was produced by John Porter. Was that the connection for you? Was that how you got involved?
Yes. Yeah, I didn't know anything about them, to be honest. In fact, that's the first I knew that. What did that? Was it an abortive attempt at an album or something?
Yes. With Troy Tate. Yeah.
Right, I didn't even knew nothing about that. No, I mean, I used to live in Shepherd's Bush in London, and just up the road in Chiswick was a studio, Eden Studios, and I'd often get a call about 10:30 when the pubs were shutting to, could you just pop up and do a bit of keyboarding on this track, Any money in it? Well, we might get 20 quid or something like that, So I didn't know much about the Smiths. I knew John. He called me up. He said, I'm producing this band, Manchester. They've got a big cult following. And it's a bit unusual. Do you fancy coming up and having a go? And that was it, really. They'd already recorded the tracks, the basic tracks, and I just overdubbed some keyboards.
There's a beautiful piano ornamentation, I'll call it, on Reel Around a Fountain, the opening track of the album, actually. These little flourishes and things, which are really beautiful. Was that off the cuff, or did the band have a really specific idea of what they wanted?
No, they just said, go in there and play some it, basically.
Right.
And, and he responded to it. I mean, back in those days, I used to get these sessions, you know, but I wasn't really a session player because I'm totally self-taught.
Right, yeah.
And I used to feel often quite insecure in these situations. And I'd think, well, any minute now, they're going to suss that I don't really know what I'm doing.
Okay.
And they're going to bomb me out and it'll be embarrassing. You know, I used to get away with it because, you know, I've got a good ear and I've got good instincts.
Yeah.
And sympathy and empathy for stuff, you know, even with a limited, especially back then, limited sort of technical ability or theory or anything like that. So it's really on instincts.
Yeah.
And that would have been the case with that. I mean, that would have been a one take. I don't know. It'd have been two, three at the most.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just to feel something. And no, the band didn't really have a great deal of input. I mean, Morrissey was there. I remember that. He was, I remember Johnny. Johnny Marr was probably the most outgoing. He
right.
was a nice guy. Morrissey was kind of simmering away in the corner with his glasses on.
Okay.
And I remember doing I don't even know what track it was, but I played organ on one. And he said, yeah, sounds like Reg Dixon on acid. Well,
okay.
I think he meant it as a compliment. I've never been quite sure.
Yeah, yeah. And of course, you were also the voice, as I said earlier, you were also the voice of the huge hit, enduring song, Living Years by Mike and the Mechanics, which is a real male weepy, if you like. The interesting thing about that song is, for me, it had no real meaning or resonance beyond being a very pleasant song. And then my dad died 18 years ago, and the really, really simple lyrics suddenly rang very true.
Yeah, yeah.
I wasn't aware until you said just now, actually, that your dad had died. But I guess to sing that song with the appropriate amount of gravitas, you really do have to have had those feelings.
I think so. I think so. The song, I didn't write the song. It's written, I mean, the lyric, I'm pretty sure, is B.A. Robertson. And both he and Mike lost their dads around the same time. They both had newborn sons around the same time. I mean, but it was about a bit sort of regretful and difficult relationship with the father. I didn't have that with my dad. I had a great relationship with him. But as you say, having had the loss, which was probably, I would say, the most profound experience of my life, was as an 11-year-old kid coming home from school and finding you're not going to see your dad again. It was pretty impactful, let's put it like that.
Yeah.
And definitely has some shape to your whole personality and your whole way of thinking of things. I'm a big boy now, but, you know, it's a part of you is still that little kid, you know what I mean?
Yeah, and the interesting, I'm sure you will have found this as well, the interesting thing is that the further away from, you know, your dad dying that you get, and the older you get, I can't really describe what I mean. It doesn't hurt quite as much, but it aches more, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, well, for you, it's still fairly recent. For me, as I say, I'm a dad myself, I'm a granddad.
Yeah.
It's one of those things, it can have a big effect on your life. I think it made me quite insecure as a kid, you know.
Right.
Learning that life can change.
Yes.
In a heartbeat, you know, literally. And I like. So I've always been a little bit insecure in that sense. I'm always expecting something to happen.
Right.
I mean, I should have gone into flipping therapy, let's face it. But, you know, I went into rock and roll instead.
Yeah.
So.
Which is either the antithesis of therapy or a very perverse kind of therapy. But
yes.
You're actually, as you say, you're a grandfather, but you're a father yourself. And I wondered how that has balanced for you over the years with, well, I was going to say career, but I'll say life in music.
Okay. I think it's worked out as well as you could hope. In this situation, you know, in this business, if you like. I grew up understanding what family's all about because apart from that experience, I had great support from an extended family.
Yeah.
Particularly my mum's side of the uncles and that just stepped up to the plate, you know, and was very supportive. And so I understand what that's all about. And I wanted my kids to be secure.
Mm-hmm.
So it was always difficult to have that balance of I was the breadwinner and I had to survive in the music world.
Yeah.
But the most important thing was I wanted them to have a secure life and upbringing as best I could. And to all intents and purposes, we ain't done bad. My wife's been incredible. We've had four kids, you know.
Yeah.
And they still like us, which is an achievement, I think. Yeah, well, and they're not, but they're not rock and roll kids. They would never indulge. They're just regular kids.
Yeah.
They've got regular jobs now.
Right.
Apart from one who's in my band.
Right.
But he's the black sheep of the family. Okay. Like me.
Well, Paul, to round up, obviously, you've led such a varied life in music and you've done amazing things, worked with amazing people, played wonderful places all over the globe, but often in service of other people's music. So
yeah.
I personally was very pleased not so long ago when a friend of mine had gone along to see you in a solo concert as basically someone's spare ticket was absolutely evangelical about it afterwards.
Really?
You know, you have to go see this guy. You have to see this guy.
Oh.
Which I think after 45 years or so and 17 albums is great. It must be thrilling to you to step out of the shadows a little bit with each solo album. And if you want to put it this way, get a little bit more of what you deserve.
Thank you. Well, it is. It's great. And as I say, I mentioned before, it's not been, it hasn't come easy, that's for sure. But I've had this great support from the band for a start. If I'd have said back when we were starting out, look, I can't pay you this week, they'd have still done it. You know what I mean?
Yes.
So it's all that. And we have a team spirit. There's no doubt about it, which has got us very far. So I'm enjoying being my own man, my own boss. It's not too shabby. We do nice venues. People come in, we'd say that trepidatiously, looking around for a bit of wood to touch because we want them to keep coming. Anyway, yeah, not too bad.
Brilliant. Well, Paul Carrick, thanks very much for your time. It's been a pleasure to speak to you and best of luck to you with the album and the tour and best of luck to Sheffield Wednesday as well, I suppose.
They're going to need it. Thank you.
Every generation blames the one before and all of their frustration beating on your door. I know that I'm a prisoner to all my father held so dear. I know that I'm a hostage to all his hopes and fears. I just wish I could have told him in the living years. Oh, crumpled bits of paper conversations. I'm afraid that's all we've got. You say you just don't see it. He says it's perfect sense. You just can't get agreement in this present tense. We all talk a different language.
It's too late.
I just wish I could have told him in the living years. So say, say, say it loud. Say it here. Oh, say it clear.
www.themouthmagazine.com